una presentación que me atrevo a traducirla al castellano, no así, no haré lo mismo con la exposición, que será como es lógico en inglés. Él es británico, from London, I think, y abogado de carrera. Ha ejercido también como abogado en Londres durante algún tiempo, pero pronto pasó al ámbito de la investigación y tiene entre sus escritos algunos artículos sobre el derecho en China y en la India, del que es un buen conocedor. Y pronto también entró en contacto con el Thomas Moro Institute, que es se presenta como un foro de discusión que está ubicado en Londres y pronto posiblemente también en la Universidad de Oxford. Y allí, pues, primero empezó siendo un investigador encargado y ahora ya es un investigador senior, y fundamentalmente él está dedicando un gran esfuerzo y lleva bastante tiempo trabajando en la ley natural, que es un tema que aquí a todos nos, evidentemente, nos preocupa. Eso es, pasa. Bien, por supuesto es también tanto en Londres como en Oxford, pues pertenece a diversos comités de sociedades de la Universidad de Londres y de Oxford. Entonces yo creo que con esta presentación más o menos lo tenemos a nuestro conferenciante en contexto, y lo que hago es dejarle la palabra para que nos dé una conferencia, que no he dicho el título. El título estaba ligeramente equivocado, pero es Nature, Language and the Human Science.
Thank you very much. Firstly, I'd like to start with an apology. I'm afraid that, like many of my fellow countrymen and women, when it comes to linguistic competence, that is, in terms of more than one language, I'm singularly deficient in that I only speak English. And this, for historical reasons, which I'm sure I'm willing to go into, it's teaching of languages in England are not its strength. So I'm afraid I have to read my paper in English. I understand that not everybody's that English is not necessarily familiar as it might be to everybody, so I shall try to keep my pace of delivery slow and clear. But if you don't understand something or would like me to repeat it, please, you know, feel free to interrupt. So the title of my paper is Nature, Language and the Human Sciences, and it offers suggestions for the systematic study of human action and its consequences according to an Aristotelian Thomistic account of human nature. In doing so, it also presupposes an Aristotelian and a Thomistic account of cognition and scientific knowledge acquisition. A full elaboration and defense of the Aristotelian Thomistic description of the scientific enterprise would involve establishing the essentially immaterial nature of the human intellect, the distinctively rational way it operates in its natural, that is, embodied environment via its three distinctive acts, and the manner in which, through hard and deliberate study, it becomes progressively more assimilated to the intelligible realities underlying the observable universe. It is not the purpose of this present paper to undertake such a defense, which is in any case being attempted with increasing success elsewhere. Instead, such an account is presupposed in order to focus more directly upon the way in which it might afford a satisfactory basis for an understanding of the human action system. In this respect, it is important to note at the very outset that whilst there is significant epistemic and methodological continuity among the different types of science, a crucial distinction opens up on an Aristotelian Thomistic account, no less than on its alternatives, between the physical sciences and those standardly referred to as the human sciences. Human sciences, in this sense, are sciences specifically related to the human person and the communities to which human persons give rise. They study the many different dimensions of human being, social, psychological and historical. But although each enjoys its own legitimate province, in order not to have a distorting effect on reality, each must also be set within the overall context of a correct and philosophically grounded anthropology. In particular, each must allow for the primitive and indispensable fact of human freedom, not indeed a completely unlimited freedom, but a freedom which, even when heavily constrained by specific individual or communal circumstances, nonetheless continues to remain, precisely because ontologically primitive, of at least some explanatory importance. Moreover, as set within this wider anthropological context, the various human sciences are also distinctive in that they each concern the powers of, or the products of the powers of, the very beings whose cognitive expansion as sciences it is their purpose to facilitate. In other words, unlike the physical sciences, they are not merely concerned with understanding the external material world, but are concerned with understanding it precisely as it reflects back upon or manifests indispensable regularities underlying the products of personal and interpersonal activity. In this sense, they are sciences in which the knowing mind studies its own operations and operational prerequisites. According to an Aristotelian Thomistic metaphysic, of course, it is only ever possible to know a being, any being, by becoming aware of its action in the world, since it is only knowing the palpability, it is only owing to the palpability of such action that an observer is enabled to conclude there exists an underlying substantial and abiding centre of activity at all. Nevertheless, whereas in the non-human sciences the mind's primary objects are external material beings, in the human sciences the objects of the mind's special study are the acts it engages in itself. As Aquinas puts it, that which is primarily cognized by the human intellect is the nature of material things. The act itself by which the nature of material things is cognized is secondarily cognized, and it is through this act that the intellect is itself is cognized. Indeed, precisely because it is co-natural for our intellect to look to material things, it follows that our intellect understands itself according as it is made actual by species abstracted from sensible realities. Just as in the process of cognizing external material substances, so too in the cognition of itself, the mind proceeds from that which is more extrinsic. Thus it is said that objects are understood before acts, acts before powers, and powers before the essence of the soul. Yet it is different from the cognition of external material substances, since it implies something more, namely that the act by which the intellect understands a stone is other than, and additional to, the act by which the intellect understands itself, understanding a stone. Consequently, in understanding its own operations, the intellect reflects back upon itself, according to which it understands itself to understand, and the species by which it understands. And so the species understood is secondarily that which is understood. But that which is understood primarily is the external thing of which the intelligible species is a similitude. As an embodied being, the actions of the human mind are ordered to finding expression in bodily behavior, the results of which are observable in some way, in the same way that all other external phenomena are observable. From observation of this bodily behavior, which is the externalization of the mind's interior operations, it becomes possible to infer the existence of these operations. Importantly, it follows from this that the mind learns about its operations not only from reflecting upon the consequences of its own activity, but also by observing and reflecting upon the activity of other minds with which it forms a knowing and acting community. This in no way reduces the significance of its distinctive capacity for properly reflexive knowledge, because it is only possible to draw self-referential conclusions from the actions of others insofar as the mind is aware that it shares with them a common nature, and this itself implies a precedent, reflexive, epistemologically foundational judgment. What it does point to, however, is both the inherently communal nature of human knowledge acquisition and the fact that all forms of human self-knowledge inescapably presuppose a stable ontological reality from which that knowledge derives. This reflexive capacity goes a long way to explaining the persuasiveness of Jürgen Habermas's suggestion that the human and social sciences are properly understood as reconstructive in nature. With the term reconstructive, Habermas means to point to those sciences whose proper function it is to reconstruct generative systems of rules or norms from the kaleidoscope of particular human actions. It is these generative systems, he suggests, that help account for the non-determined yet thoroughly ordered nature of such actions, affirming both their real freedom and meaningful content. Setting these suggestions within the context of an Aristotelian Thomistic account of reflexivity offers a basis for their creative completion by preserving the unique value they undoubtedly offer for a truly adequate social epistemology, whilst prescinding from the limitations of Habermas's wider post-Kantian anti-metaphysical commitments. Equally important is the role that implicit, or as Michael Polanyi has more recently termed it, tacit knowledge, plays in the Habermasian account. Thus, essential to the procedure of the reconstructive sciences properly conceived is the transformation of a practically mastered pre-theoretical knowledge, know-how, of competent subjects into an objective and explicit knowledge, know-that. In other words, a reconstructive science transforms implicit into explicit knowledge by explicating the inherently human tendency to behave in an ordered and rule-governed manner. At the same time, it is not simply concerned to reconstruct any and every practically demonstrated competence, but only those of a universal or species-defining nature. To the extent that the universal validity claims underlie intuitive evaluations, Habermas says, reconstructions relate to pre-theoretical knowledge of a general sort, to universal capabilities, and not only to particular competences of individual groups, or to the ability of particular individuals. When the pre-theoretical knowledge to be reconstructed expresses a universal capability, a general cognitive, linguistic, or interactive competence or subcompetence, then what begins as an explication of meaning aims at the reconstruction of species competences. It is this that enables the social critic to tease out the most significant structural implications of the tendencies underlying human action, as well as the types of capacities its manifestation presupposes. What constitutes the correct or healthy functioning of those capacities? What constitutes their malfunctioning? How the variable degrees of healthy functioning and malfunctioning might be measured? and the longer term consequences of each. A moment's reflection makes clear that to be at all credible, the pre-theoretical knowledge required by this account must be premised upon some mechanism of habit formation. And it is the elaboration of just such a mechanism that has been a peculiarly distinguishing feature of the Aristotelian tradition. It is in writing within this tradition, whilst trying to make sense of more recent conceptions of linguistic competence, that Polanyi has pointed to the inherently self-contradictory notion of explicit knowledge devoid of tacit coefficients, since this would render, as he says, all spoken words, all formulae, all maps and graphs strictly meaningless. Quite to the contrary, from its earliest age, nearly every child engages in a vast range of behaviour underpinned by a set of norms of apparent infinite complexity, which are intelligible, if at all, only to a handful of experts. And it does so because it is because its striving imagination has the power to implement its aims by the subsidiary practice of ingenious rules of which it remains focally ignorant. In doing so, suggests Polanyi, the child, in fact, discovers a whole new system of tacit grammar, and its imagination enables it to apply this to each new situation it encounters. Excuse me. Thus, from its very start, the child takes up the problem which will guide its quest throughout, the task of improving communication. The growth of vocabulary and the acquisition of ever more complex and subtle grammatical rules are both activated by the imaginative search for greater enrichment and greater precision in communication. Semantic sense-giving and sense-reading are striven for ever further, as the twin powers of intuition and imagination work towards this from start to finish. Of particular importance for Habermas are the generative systems underlying communication. I take, he says, the type of action aimed at reaching understanding to be fundamental. Thus I start from the assumption that other forms of social action, for example conflict, competition, a strategic action in general, are derivatives of action orientated to reaching understanding. Although communicative action, as he terms it, performs a less constitutive, substantivist, more properly characteristic role relative to human, to healthy human functioning in the systems of Aristotle and Aquinas, the central position Habermas affords it here nonetheless resonates strongly with the premium his predecessors place upon the inherently social nature of the human person, and the way each consequently asserts with the greatest possible emphasis the indispensable nature of socially mediated action and interaction in the attainment of human flourishing. If man is by nature a political animal, states contemporary termist John O'Callaghan, it stands to reason that his political life, which necessarily involves communication, is the flower of his more basic vital activities or forms of life. Thus his political life is his flourishing, the more perfect existence that the individual naturally seeks, without which his individual existence is naturally incomplete and naturally less than perfect. It follows that being rational, linguistic and political are the specifically human ways of being an animal. As Aristotle himself states, everyone needs to communicate his thoughts to others, and it is communicative action taken in this widest sense, action of which language, as normally understood, is the central or paradigm case that makes this possible. Through language, men interact with one another, using meaningful expressions, and it is this which enables them to live together as a community. It is the handmaiden of a completing unity forged across time and space, propelled by the common fundamental human desire for knowledge, understanding and wisdom. Thus, when Aristotle distinguishes between understanding as such and the vocal expression of understanding, he is not necessarily distinguishing things, two things, that is, two acts. He is, in the first place, providing sufficient space for recognizing that understanding is expressed in all human action, and not just the manipulation of verbal or written symbols. He is also, in the second place, leaving sufficient conceptual space for a movement, that is, a development of the understanding expressed in all the modes of human action to the more perfect form of existence embodied in the expression of speech, which is the fruit of understanding shared with the community. The indivisibly material and immaterial nature of human being confers inherent meaningfulness upon properly human action, which brings together communicative and expressive qualities, in virtue of which both the internal operations, acts, and thoughts of the human spirit are externalized in the material world, and the intelligible aspects of reality are made simultaneously available to more than one mind. In this way, it can be seen that conceptual and volitional functioning on the part of the human animal is naturally ordered towards expression in non-linguistic and linguistic acts alike, forming through these linguistic and non-linguistic acts social and political communities. Moreover, even within the context of an individual's private conceptual functioning, it would seem that some sort of organized symbolic system is necessary, owing to the fact, noted earlier, that all human thought, being that of embodied intellect, is essentially orientated towards cognition of universals in particulars. Consequently, as Anthony Hare says, to fix and recall items from the flux of experience, to be able to use this recalled knowledge in inferences and associations, we need words to stand as recallable proxies for the things we want to argue and think about. In order for this to be possible, thought needs to take on a quasi-embodied existence. It must be something symbolically encoded, something the believer can retain and think about. In this way, language makes possible thought about absent things, about generalities, and about possibility and impossibility. It's important to note here that it is precisely the embodied nature of the human intellect, and thus of the mind's conceptual functioning, that renders the human being a rational being ordered towards activity of a distinctively rational kind. Communicative action represents both a subset of the wider category of rational action, as well as being its most complete expression. Crucially, it also follows from this that all distinctively human action would itself be possessed of a certain dual character. On the one hand, the basis for the underlying unity it displays is the capacity of the human mind to become conceptually enriched by intelligible aspects of reality. As intelligible and therefore immaterial, these aspects and the concepts into which they are formed are, at least in principle, inherently communicable to all other minds. It is for this reason that all human languages are capable of some form of translation, and indeed why individual persons are capable of engaging in mutually intelligible discourse at all. On the other hand, as the human mind is that of a being composed of essential immaterial and material metaphysical co-principles, whatever conceptual content the mind possesses or seeks to communicate must necessarily be in some manner embodied. And it is this embodiment that forms the basis of linguistic diversity. That diversity exists at a number of different levels. It exists first at the relatively superficial level of phonology or physical notation, where it is accounted for by the inherently conventional nature of linguistic signifiers. Secondly, diversity exists at the level of individual grammars, which bring together a natural grammatical endowment with its particular realizations through a series of conventionally mediated, though nonetheless tightly constrained choices. Finally, diversity also exists at the level of conceptual enrichment. This is because, just as different people will know different things about the world, so too at the level of communal understanding, given the various traditions of inquiry, environmental interactions, and condensations of experience, different languages will have developed different conceptual vocabularies, idiomatic expressions, and forms of speech, each of which group together meanings both singularly and collectively in quite distinctively, though not, of course, mutually untranslatable ways. The surface depth character that all this confers upon the human action system manifests itself not just as between particular actions, but also as between whole clusters of actions premised upon the development by their agents of habituated propensities to act in one way rather than another. Finally, and perhaps most significantly for the present paper, owing to the inherently social nature of the human being, this surface depth character also manifests itself in the embodied propensities of whole communities to act in one way rather than another. At this point, an important distinction needs to be drawn between the possession of the capacity to act on the one hand and the employment or use of that capacity on the other. This corresponds to a distinction Aquinas draws between virtues of the intellect and those of the will. By doing so, he points to the fact that it is possible to develop both intellectually and morally. It is possible to develop intellectually by requiring a more refined capacity to reason to conclusions from the first principles of a science, a deeper understanding of life, a more discerning sensitivity in making practical judgments, and a more adept skill at making things. It is possible to develop morally by developing habits such as those of treating people justly and of responding appropriately to one's various desires. This, he says, is because there are two principles of human action, namely intellect or reason and appetite. Hence, any human virtue must be perfective of one or the other of these principles. If it is perfective of the speculative or practical intellect, so that a person acts well, it is an intellectual virtue. If it is perfective of the appetitive part, it is a moral virtue. At the same time, it is also important to notice a qualitative difference between these two types of habit. A man is not said to be good absolutely because he may be good in some part, but because he is wholly good. And this he is when his will is good. A man who is good in one of his powers without having a good will is said to be good as regards that power, e.g. because he has good vision or hearing. It is clear then a man is not said to be absolutely good from the fact that he has science, but only to have a good mind or good understanding. The like may be said of art and of other habits of this sort. If only everybody, all of us, could write as clearly as Aquinas. Thus, because intellectual virtues, whether those of the theoretical intellect or of the practical intellect, confer only aptness to act, not the right use of that aptness, they are correctly taken to be virtues only in a relative or analogical sense. Whereas virtues of the will are virtues properly so called, or virtues without qualification. Only habits that dispose appetite give both capacity and the bent to use that capacity well, points out Ralph McInerney. Indeed, the tendency to act well is precisely the capacity that they are said to confer. It follows from this that any human action capable of being appraised technically can also be appraised morally, and that these two appraisals remain analytically distinct. In particular, whereas moral appraisal relates to the good of the whole person, technical appraisal relates only to the good of the particular work done. As Maritain puts it in his famous work, Art and Scholasticism, which is making a comeback recently in England because the Archbishop of Canterbury recently delivered a series of lectures on it. Right. Making is ordered to such and such a definite end, separate and self-sufficient, not to the common end of human life. And it relates to the peculiar good or perfection, not of the man making, but of the work made. The paradigm case here is, of course, art. Art concerns itself primarily with the production of things external to the agent, and is thus to be contrasted with the pure inwardness of knowing, which is the proper concern of science. Yet this basic distinction also admits of a degree of mutual overlap. Consequently, there also exist certain peculiarly speculative arts, which are at the same time sciences. Logic is the most obvious example. Such scientific arts, writes Maritain, perfect the speculative intellect, not the practical intellect. But the sciences in question retain in their manner an element of the practical, and are arts only because they involve the making of a work. In this case, a work wholly within the mind, whose sole object is knowledge, a work which consists in putting order into our concepts, in framing a proposition or an argument. The result is then that whenever you find an art, you find some action or operation to be contrived, some work to be done. Thus there is a sense in which all distinctively human action, that is all rational action and then by further implication all communicative and linguistic action, involves the cultivation and practice of some art or arts. To understand then something of the generative mechanisms that underline such action is not yet to have a full grasp of the human action system. It is instead merely to understand how it is possible for individual creative acts to be engaged in, or to understand something of the manner in which the unique products of the human mind are bodied forth in the world. This is to deal with the method of bringing about the goods internal to those individual products. There are deeper questions it leaves untouched, which relate to the functioning of the human action system as a whole, which is, of course, synonymous with the good of the person as a whole. These questions require separate consideration, and are precisely in the province of the virtues of the will. The will, as intellective appetite, bears on things the mind sees as good, and there are certain things that are seen to be necessary components of the complete human good. Indeed, the mind grasps them as goods to which we as individuals are already necessarily inclined. Virtue, as second nature, is the perfection of a natural inclination towards the good. Judgments about goods to which we are naturally inclined form the starting points, or principles of moral discourse. If particular choices are analysed in terms of a kind of syllogism that applies a moral rule to particular circumstances, the principles are non-gainsayable precepts, that is, basic precepts, that we articulate when less general guides for action are questioned. The set of the principles of moral discourse is what Aquinas means by natural law. These judgments as to what one ought to do cannot be coherently denied. In this sense, they are likened to the first principles of reasoning in general. And Aquinas has in mind the way, in which the principle of non-contradiction is defended. The equivalent of the principle of non-contradiction in the moral order is, of course, good should be pursued and done, and evil avoided. It makes no sense to commend evil because in doing so one must commend it, as Aquinas says, under the form of good, namely, as desirable and worthy of pursuit. The other basic or non-gainsayable moral principles are articulations or specifications of this basic one. As Aquinas says, this is the foundation of all the other precepts of nature's law, such that whatever things practical reason naturally grasps to be human goods pertain to natural law's precepts as to what is to be done or avoided. In answering the question on what basis will practical reason judge something to be a human good or a constituent of the comprehensive human good, Aquinas gives the following answer. Since good has the character of an end and evil the contrary character, all those things to which a man has a natural inclination, reason naturally grasps as goods, and consequently as things to be pursued, and it grasps their contraries as things to be avoided. Thus, human beings have in common with everything an inclination to preserve themselves in existence. In common with other animals, they have an inclination to mate, have young, and care for them. And they have a peculiar inclination following on their defining trait, reason, to know and to converse and to live together in society. The fact that the generative mechanisms which, it has been suggested, underlie and make possible the exercise of meaningful human action are capable of being analysed independent of the deeper precepts of the natural law should not be taken to imply that they are not related one to another. Clearly they are. Indeed, a proper observance of the natural law is vital to maintaining the fundamental integrity of the overall action system. Insofar as its precepts come habitually to be departed from, to that extent, truly interpersonal and reciprocal, that is, fully communicative, human action starts to become problematic. And here, such a departure may be usefully contrasted with potential departures from basic linguistic and grammatical norms. Thus, if the grammatical principles underlying meaningful discourse are disregarded, if a person starts to speak ungrammatically, it soon becomes clear that they are speaking nonsense. They will simply not be able to achieve their communicative purposes. In contrast, the consequences of breaching the basic precepts of the natural law take much longer to manifest themselves, though those consequences are altogether more insidious and profound. Now, given the surface depth nature of human action in general, and consequently the fact that a whole variety of different schemes are consistent with the natural law when it comes to concrete action. When it comes to concrete action, the principles of the natural law are incapable of manifesting themselves in an unmediated form. They must always be found either to have transgressed or to have been complied with within the context of an agent or group of agents executing a particular judgment or set of judgments, or in the context of the development by those agents of habituated propensities to do so. For this reason, when it comes to the systematic departure from the precepts of the natural law, it is obvious that this will eventually become manifest in its mediating norm systems. In other words, it will eventually become manifest in changes to normative schemes which individuals and communities through their actions have purposed to create. Here, it is important to distinguish three types of norms. Language, law, as in human law, and the norms of or the laws of physical nature. And I want to focus on the second law, that is human law. Law is a system of norms which regulates the behavior of society, but it is crucially distinguishable on the one hand from language and on the other from the laws of physical nature. The reason why this distinction is of crucial importance is because it isolates what is distinctive in the concept of law, as I'm using the term here. Namely, that it includes the notion of social pressure or coercion. The notion of social pressure I'm treating to cover many, many, many different types of activity, including physical threats, right down to very subtle forms of social pressure which manifest themselves through differential social hierarchies. I'm also linking it to some extent with the types of pressure which are required for the internal disciplining of the passions and the habits, that is, in the cultivation of the virtues. On this basis, I want to argue that these norms of social pressure are inherently expressive of the priorities of the state of a human society at any given time, and that for this reason, when understood within what I have so far said, they offer a peculiarly effective indicator of social development and corruption. In contrast then to law, language and the laws of physical nature are not susceptible to fundamental change. What I mean by that is that their fundamental underpinnings are not susceptible to fundamental change. Sorry, their basic underpinnings are not susceptible to fundamental change. In an obvious way, the laws of physical nature are not, at least at the Newtonian level, susceptible to any variation at all. They're not subject, they may be subject to chance, but they're not subject to any form of volition. Whilst language may vary in its particular personal and communal manifestation, but remains constantly underpinned by a set of universal governing principles, as we've seen. Law is, in fact, an admixture of these other two. Law, human law, is an admixture of these other two varieties of norm system. Or more precisely, it occupies a variable intermediate point between the two extremities that they respectively represent. At one extreme, language can be seen as manifesting man's social being in its natural state. That is, it represents a perfect balance between structure and volition, between unity and diversity. It allows for maximal, spontaneous and uncoerced expression, which is nonetheless guaranteed and made intelligible by the largely unconscious employment of regular underlying patterns. If we were to live in a society of unfallen beings, we would all interact in this uncoerced, spontaneous and natural way. Because we don't, other factors come into play. So there's language. At the other extreme, the laws of physical nature wholly exclude any notion of volition and represent a more or less inflexible unfolding of the physical universe, subject to the qualifications about chance. In contrast to both these extremes, the concept of law, of human law that I've outlined, taken in its broadest sense, like that of language, incorporates the idea of volition and therefore is distinguishable from the laws of physical nature, but unlike language, implies some degree of restriction on the scope of that volition. It's precisely because people don't act in a fully spontaneous, reciprocal, mutually respectful way that it's necessary to engage different forms of normative pressure. Sorry, my good friend Pedro has just walked in. Now what I want to say is that law in this sense, by its very nature, implies a distinction between actions that are permissible and are not. It's for this reason that when you look at the quality of law as it manifests itself in a particular grouping, and remember I'm defining law as a norm of social pressure, if you look at that, the type of pressure or the type of social pressure that it manifests normatively, you can say something about the structural state of that society. In this sense, legal norms have existed in various guises throughout history. Now, I would like, historically, it's a fact that there has been a general movement towards more formal or positivized manifestations of these norms of social pressure, of law, and away from more informal ones. And I have to make a terminological point here. I'm using human law as Aquinas would use human law. I'm using positive law and this notion of positivization in a way which is distinct from the way that he would use it. I'm using it in a way that most modern analytic jurisprudence use it. By positivization, I mean notions of spatio-temporal fixation and numerical individuation. As the norms of social pressure or coercion become gradually more positivized, they become proportionately more inflexible. So this process of positivization that one can notice historically represents a cognate process of increasing social fixation. It also means that these norms of social pressure begin to emerge in a more determinate and less spontaneous fashion. As such, they also become less like the norms of language and more like the norms of physical nature. There is a story, a wider story underlying this, which links the positivization of legal norms, of the norms of social pressure, to a process of systematic materialization of social being. That is a story that I don't want to elaborate upon further today, because there's a time limit. Thank you very much.